KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Teamsters Local 206, helping Oregon's working families fight for good jobs and a better future. For information about how the Teamsters can help you win respect at work, the number is 503-251-2344. And also by Ask Me Local 88, protecting worker rights and fighting to improve the wages and working conditions of members who work for Multnomah County, Central City Concern, Transition Projects, and American Friends Service Committee. More information at 503-239-9858 or www.local88.ws.
Good evening. Good evening and welcome to Labor Radio, a weekly program about working people, the labor movement, and organizing on KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. I'm your host, Don McIntosh. Tonight's show is about Wall Street's love affair with the pink slip. In less than a generation, American workers lost the job security that it took a generation to win. Today, in good times and in bad, America's biggest companies are downsizing, tossing workers to the scrap heap in the name of greater short-term profit. Louis Uchitel, economics reporter for the New York Times, has authored a book, The Disposable American, Layoffs and Their Consequences. The book takes an in-depth look at the impact of mass layoffs on workers, their families, and communities. In a few seconds, he'll join us by phone from his home in Scarsdale, New York. Later in the show, we'll talk with Gordon Lafer, labor studies professor at the University of Oregon and author of the book The Job Training Charade. In the book, Professor Lafer argues that the federal government's job training programs for displaced workers are less about putting them back to work and more about minimizing political damage from mass layoffs. And in the final part of the hour, we'll talk for a few minutes about a public hearing scheduled for this Thursday in Portland about workers' rights to unionize at Providence Health Systems. Oregon Secretary of State Bill Bradbury has agreed to officiate at the hearing, which is organized by the Workers' Rights Board of Portland Jobs with Justice. Last week, in response, Providence Management and the Oregon Association of Hospitals sent Bradbury a strongly worded and vaguely threatening letter. We'll hear more about that from Margaret Butler of Portland Jobs with Justice at the end of this hour. Now I'd like to welcome Lou Uchitel to KBOO's Labor Radio. Lou, are you with us?
Yes, I certainly am. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. A terrific book, I have to say. Almost no one, it seems, is looking at things like the psychological impact of layoffs, which have really become an everyday occurrence that is almost unremarkable.
Yes, that, I think, is the one of the things you do when you write a book that you don't do as a daily reporter, a newspaper reporter, is you follow in over a long period of time people who have, in this case, been laid off. And I found, more than I ever imagined, that I was constantly running into the psychiatric aspects of layoffs. People would talk to me endlessly about their own culpability. They blamed themselves for their own layoffs. And we then reinforce that by telling them that all they have to do is go out and get good training and education, and that will open the door to good jobs. And when they don't get the good jobs, then we tell them they didn't do the right training or the right education. They didn't do the right thing. In effect, what we've left them with is the message that we do not value you. The income you were, the wages we were paying you weren't worth your weren't worth those wages. And that's a terrific blow to self-esteem. When you go to psychiatrists about that, they say, yes, we run across it all the time, and people don't come to us because of layoffs, but in therapy this often comes up. And I've discussed this at some length with psychiatrists. I relate all this in the book, in The Disposable American, and they acknowledge that, in fact, they do not put a warning label on layoffs, and they probably should, just as we put warning labels on cigarettes. It's dangerous to your mental health.
And yet it seems like you really had to hunt down to find psychiatrists who had actually looked at that issue. There was a lot of talk about just generally a correlation between, for example, unemployment and, you know, psychiatric distress, but not so much about the layoff itself, which was really the cause of unemployment for most of these folks.
Well, there's two things here. I'm sorry. You shouldn't mix up unemployment with layoffs. Many people who are laid off go on to jobs, often at salaries less than what they got, they earned before, and in tasks that don't use all their skills. But the layoff itself, the message that you do not have value, is damaging, is psychologically damaging, even if to people who end up working again a week later. And that is the, we have plenty of studies that correlate mental illness and anguish, mental illness as a result of long periods of unemployment. We have almost nothing that that describes the mental health damage that results from a layoff.
I'm not sure if you're so much guilty of this as maybe other economics reporters, but there's a tendency to talk about economics in the press as if it was sort of, you know, impersonal forces of nature, when in reality, of course, it's a, you know, it's a cascade of human decisions that have real human consequences. And I think, you know, although there's lots of history, which I'd like to get into, history and some analysis in your book, I really felt like the emotional heart of it was the individual stories of these workers from all walks of life, and not just the stereotype of the blue-collar manufacturing worker, but white-collar workers, even at the higher echelons of the corporate world.
Yes, my book is essentially about not poor people, but about the highly skilled blue-collar workers, aviation mechanics, and white-collar workers, administrators, people earning five- and six-figure salaries. The damage is the same across the spectrum. And I think I think you're right that economics, it does not emphasize the personal damage. It's much. It's an entirely different sort of dynamic. But I think you are. I noticed in the press more and more accounts of personal stories. They haven't arrived at the conclusion that I did, or the finding that I did, that mental health was being undermined, and as a result, public health was undermined. The point of that is that if we are damaging public health, or if we're damaging people's health, if you will, that's a social issue. It means that the layoffs can't simply be left to the company. They have to be treated in a broader perspective.
I've actually felt, and not just reading your book, but certainly now for years, I feel like we live in a time of pervasive kind of anxiety, and not just about terrorism, you know, really, or even crime, but I mean, I think economic anxiety above all. People are afraid. I guess it was George Bush Senior. He was running for re-election. I think he slipped and said, if I'm elected, everyone who has a job will want a job. Of course, he meant everyone who wants a job will have a job, but it ended up being, in fact, somewhat of an accurate statement in that not so much for him, but for Clinton, a lot of folks, who had jobs, who had long-term stable jobs, found that the carpet was pulled out from under them during this era. I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the history, because, and to me this is a little bit new reading about it, but I think there was sort of a time before the 20th century when no one really expected job security, and then somehow in the post-World War II era, that became the norm.
No, it didn't quite work that way. I'm trying with this book to lay out let me put it this way. Starting in the late 19th century, we began to develop job security, a unique American form of job security that management as well as labor sought. The big giant corporations developed in the late 1800s, Eastman Kodak, U.S. Steel, DuPont, the big railroads, they all were complex organizations that required skilled and experienced people to run them. And the managers and owners of these companies pushed for policies that kept workers in place. Procter & Gamble, for example, set up a pension fund that exists to this day that encouraged people to stay through a career in order to collect a much bigger payoff. And, well, they did it because of the needs of the company. They also did it a year after the Haymarket riots because of the labor unrest and the reluctance of William Proctor to lose skilled people. He was concerned about that. That was called welfare capitalism, and it was as much instigated by managers as it was by labor. And then along came the Depression. There was much less interest on the part of management to maintain jobs. But the New Deal labor laws kicked in, and that furthered job security. And after the war, we lived in a nation in which all sides, with the memory of the Depression still fresh, all sides believed in job security. That was a political goal. It was a management goal. It was a labor goal. It was everyone's goal. And so you should think of the post-war years as sort of the culmination of something that had started nearly 100 years earlier. Then in the late 70s, we got into competition, first with the Japanese over cars, and then over tools, hand tools, for example. I devote one chapter of the Disposable American to what happened at the Stanley Works in New Britain, Connecticut, a famous manufacturer of hand tools. And we dealt with that with layoffs, and perhaps that was a legitimate response at first, but it soon got out of hand, and we, starting in the late 70s and lasting right up until the late 90s, we step-by-step dismantled the obstacles to layoffs, the resistance to them, until we finally acquiesced, and we forgot that there were other alternatives and that layoffs weren't the only inevitable result, the only inevitable solution of quote-unquote globalization. Now, I don't want to say that there won't be layoffs. We can't turn the clock back on the way this world works. I do want to say, and the whole point of this book, I think, now that I've written it, is to make people aware of what has happened and to have the tools, if you will, or the information to push back, to say, look, 10 layoffs aren't necessary, 5 are enough, or 3 are enough, and there's a mental health issue involved, so we have to deal with this as a communal thing. We have to try to find people other jobs within the company. I'm just giving that as an example.
Sure.
It has to be a social issue.
In case you've just joined the program, you're listening to Labor Radio. I'm Don McIntosh. My guest is New York Times reporter Louis Uchitel, who's talking about his new book, The Disposable American, Layoffs and Their Consequences. That was one of the things that leaped out about me in your book a few times, is this idea of societal acquiescence. Because I think the idea that there was any alternative, that you could say no to layoffs. I was reminded, for example, of the case in which this whole community, was it in Pennsylvania, sort of rose up and attempted to stop a large layoff, a closure of a steel mill. Can you tell us about that?
It wasn't that they rose up. At that moment, the first big layoff in America, the first mass layoff of 5,000 workers almost overnight, took place at the Campbell Works near Young, within the bounds, within the metropolitan area of the Youngstown, Ohio, just west of Pennsylvania, and it made headlines. And what the community did, a number of civic organizations, prominent religious leaders, the Catholic Church, all formed and got together and said, well, if the private sector can't run this mill, we'll take it over. They appealed to President Carter for a loan so that they could modernize the mill. The mill was not competitive with foreign steel makers. Carter came up with $500 million loan guarantee. they went ahead, or they tried to go ahead, and then it collapsed. The attempt to collapse, they collapsed partly because the union wouldn't support it. The United Steelworkers, that was partly because of a political dispute within the union that that stopped the union from backing it, partly because Carter pulled out. That, and there were other similar attempts that took place, and none of them ever really worked. My point is, as these attempts were made and failed, people stopped doing them. And there were other similar occasions, events, where people tried to stop something. It was new. It was novel. I once did a story about the Harvard class of 1958 at its 35th reunion. There was a breakfast because several of the class members, not several, a number of them had been laid off. Everybody was shocked. How could a Harvard man, it was men in those days, not women, be laid off? And there was a breakfast. There was an attempt to help them. We did a front page story. I did a big Sunday business section story that drew a lot of attention. Well, I also went to the 35th reunion of the class of 68. By then, layoffs had become so commonplace among Ivy League schools that nobody took much notice of it except myself. And no one went in my interviewing. There was plenty of layoffs, same as before, but it just was no longer an issue. It was taken for granted.
Again, this idea of, you know, really in a short time span, maybe a couple of decades, something, you know, being considered unthinkable, becoming something that's commonplace. And I think, again, that people took personally. You write that whereas in the Depression, there was a sense that this was happening to everyone and it wasn't a personal failure. Now, basically, people, you know, even though they may rationalize it and say, well, it's not my fault, a lot of other people were going, they always wonder, well, why was it me that was picked? Or those who stayed behind, maybe they feel guilty.
Well, that is an issue, and it comes down again to this business of blaming ourselves and to this myth that we have. I sort of speak of three myths. One of the myths is that it's that good jobs are out there, and people can segue from the jobs they lose into jobs that are just as good and pay well through education and training. And the fact of the matter is that the demand for good jobs is greater than the supply of them, and we don't recognize. And there's a number of Labor Department statistics that recognize that, but politically we don't. It's convenient for the Republicans and the Democrats to embrace education as the solution. It means you don't have to deal in labor policies or government policies or anything of the sort. And of course, it's easier for CEOs who are quite human, and if they really stop to think about the psychological damage they did, they might pull back a bit. But in fact, if you can hold the victims themselves responsible for the outcome, then you don't have to worry so much about what you're doing.
And that's exactly what the policy shifts of the last 20 years have done. It's been an emphasis, particularly in the Clinton years, on education and retraining, which is all about the worker themselves being responsible for continued employment. You know, up to and including, I know of cases, for example, here in Portland, where, you know, someone was laid off from a lumber mill, got retrained to work in high tech. There was a boom and a bust there. Then they were laid off from high tech. I know someone laid off from high tech who went and studied to become a medical transcriptionist, only to find that work could be outsourced to India as well, and was laid off again. I mean, there's just a kind of a race to find out, you know, what kinds of jobs can you, you know, are we all going to be working in the healthcare profession in a few years? I mean, at some point you begin to wonder whether there needs to be a national strategy or industrial policy, which is sort of like a forbidden word, I think, in the national economic circles.
I don't think it has to be. I mean, first of all, I don't think offshoring has a lot to do with it yet. Most of the layoffs that take, despite all the publicity, most of the layoffs that take place today are quite within the country. The number, and we've done stories about this, the number of jobs that have actually gone offshore are still quite small, probably less than a million so far, which isn't a lot. The issue really is how do we deal with it? Well, one of the issues is that over this period of time, we've gone from a sense of a communal society. We've reemphasized, as we had in the past, this idea of People should stand on their own 2 feet. Our economic policy has shifted away from a communal approach that is a mixture of government and markets, the New Deal approach, if you will. And this is, I'm not advocating a return to the New Deal, but a mixture of markets
why
government.
What? Why not?
Well, let me say what I think.
Okay.
I'm a reporter, and I think that this has to come from the bottom up, not from policymakers or pundits. The question that people have to answer, and each person has to answer it, is it possible for the markets to generate enough good jobs at good pay to meet all the demand for them? That is full employment. Or is that not possible for the market, for the private sector to do, even with the best will in the world? And that's a question that came up in the Employment Act of 1946, the debate over it. We rejected the idea of the government as an employer of last resort. It came up again in the early drafts of the Humphrey-Hawkins bill, Humphrey-Hawkins Act in the mid-70s. We rejected it then. Augustus Hawkins, one of the sponsors, a black congressman from Watts, who had plenty of unemployment in his district, argued that the private sector by itself couldn't employ everybody, and there was a need for the government to supplement this. That doesn't mean government jobs. It would mean something like public sector projects that are necessary, like rebuilding schools or upgrading the air traffic control system, all sorts of things that might go out to private contractors who then would employ people essentially doing government work.
Right, there's a quote in your book. Here's the quote. If at any time there are not sufficient jobs in private employment to go around, then government can and must create additional job opportunities because there must be jobs for all in this country of ours. And
my quote.
No, it isn't. Do you recall whose it is?
I think that might have been Augustus Hawkins.
No,
quote.
It was Thomas Dewey, the Republican candidate for president in 1944. I raised that just to show how far the debate has shifted. Even as late as the 1970s, it was sort of acknowledged. I mean, you mentioned the 1946 Employment Act, which declares, I've actually mentioned it on this show a few times, but it declares that it's the policy of the United States of America to have full employment for its workers. And what's interesting that we find now is that the Federal Reserve is acting in direct contradiction to that. They have,
yes,
in the last couple of decades, their fear is inflation because they're protecting bondholders. Their fear is inflation, and they believe that that higher wages are promoting inflation, and therefore they know that the labor market works such that the more people chasing jobs, that's a break on wages. So they want to create a certain amount of unemployment above 5%, if I'm not mistaken. So I'm just thinking, if those folks, those 5% that are, you know, that they're literally trying to engineer to be unemployed, generally speaking, in society, if they're doing us a favor as inflation breakers, I think they ought to get compensated for it.
Well,
without commenting
one way or another on your argument, I forgot that I had quoted Dewey on that point. The point of that is that we all believed in full employment after World War II and after the experience of the Depression, and in that whole period, we recognized a role for government as a supplement to the markets. It came out of the war period. It came out of the Depression years. We were highly successful as a nation, and we were in sync on this whole policy. My point in all this, you're pointing it out, is to remind everybody of that sequence of events and how we have then entered a period in which we dismantled all those safeguards, if you will.
Right, and so again, it's not that something happened by accident, although certainly the U.S.'s position economically changed in the world. I'm sure that's an influence. I mean, it's easy to be generous when the rising tide is lifting all boats. At this point, the tide may be rising a little bit, but some of us are in yachts and some of us are paddling. In the last section of your book, you make some recommendations. I don't know if you want to call yourself an advocate or not, but you at least discuss that there are some measures that government could take, that we as a society could take.
I would emphasize two measures more than any other, and I think that people, if we counted the number of layoffs accurately, and the government doesn't. We only get a partial count. We would come up with, instead of 4% of all the full-time workers, which is what the current displaced worker count of government now produces, if we counted the hidden layoffs, the forced retirements and buyouts, we would come up, and I worked out this estimate working with the Labor Department economists, Bureau of Labor Statistics economists, we would come up with probably 7% of all full-time workers in this country are laid off annually. That's a lot. It would alarm people. It would become a political issue that couldn't be avoided. It would become a question for chief executives to face as a matter of public relations for their in the marketplace. The second thing, and a very important one, would be I think companies should be required to make the equivalent of environmental impact statements. That is, every year they should be required to file a report in which they list how people left their company that year, by resignation, by voluntary retirement, by forced retirement, whatever it might be, by layoff. And then with all that data collected, you would come up with, say, an average of, say, 100 layoffs a month in the airline industry as an average. And then there would be this airline with 150. And suddenly the spotlight would focus on that airline. Why is it above average? Certainly globalization isn't a reason. And companies would become much more concerned about how they proceeded and more careful to stick within the averages. Remember, coming into this era, layoffs were considered a mark of incompetence on the part of a company. They had to lay off workers because they weren't doing well. And we would go back to that sort of era with that sort of information and that sort of standard.
It does suggest maybe bad management if the idea is that you've recruited, you've hired, you've trained a bunch of folks, and now all of a sudden you're going to throw that human investment away. I guess it calls to question whether management decisions earlier were wise.
Well, the cost in human investment and in capital investment is gigantic, and I lay this out in the chapter about the United Airlines Maintenance Center in Indianapolis, which was, because of a labor dispute, closed, and the operation was outsourced, and the mechanics lost their jobs, whereas 30 years ago, when outsourcing didn't exist and layoffs were not acceptable at all, the management and unions would have and workers would have come to an agreement. They would have been forced to do so. And in this case, in this particular dispute, both sides were very much at full, had blame. It could be blamed for what happened.
But in
they
any
would
case,
have worked
the,
it out.
The human story was, I think, one of the strongest parts of your book. This is a case where there, an individual with a family, promising career, basically is, if not destroyed, at least, I mean, he's a shadow of his former self by the end of the book. Largely, because of the layoff. And you asked the question, I think, very poignantly, what good does it do to society to have a highly skilled and experienced aircraft mechanic who could be keeping planes safe in the air and so forth, operating a little boat, taking tourists from place to place in Florida? And when we downsize, when we lay people off, we're losing not only the connections they have with their coworkers, and we're losing, their kind of enthusiasm and so forth, but we're losing all that, potential production that is no longer going to be made, and many times for a very short-sighted, maybe profit goal, looking
well,
good
you,
to
you're
investors.
Adding a lot of judgments and with which I didn't either agree nor disagree, which they're fine. I just want to sort of sort myself out as a reporter and make the point that my book is a descriptive book as much as I can make it, because I think I find that in describing, for example, the emotional damage, it varies greatly from person to person. Some people bounce back quickly, and I think I illustrated that with one mechanic. Others avoid taking jobs that are challenging because they don't want to go through the pain of another layoff. Some six-figure executives who are only in their 40s or early 50s drop out of the labor, don't work again. They've saved enough. They just don't want to go through that experience again. We're, layoffs are generating a certain alienation towards work in this country.
You know, I want to thank you for joining us tonight. I want to maybe end with this is a it's a quote from your final chapter. I think you sort of start that chapter with a philosophical question. That is, are we going to once again be a community of people who feel obligated to take care of one another, or are we going to continue as a collection of individuals, each one increasingly concerned only with his or her well-being?
I thank you for quoting that. I feel very strongly on that point.
Louis Uchitel, it's been a pleasure to have you on Labor Radio.
Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks for joining us. We've been talking with Louis Uchitel, economics reporter for the New York Times and author of a terrific book, The Disposable American, Layoffs and Their Consequences. We're joined now, as I understand, by Gordon Lafer, a professor at the Labor Education and Research Center of the University of Oregon. Gordon, are you with us?
I am here.
And have you been able to hear that last that segment?
You know, unfortunately, I heard your questions and not the answers.
Okay, well, a little technical difficulty. We can talk, however, about your book and kind of maybe summarize a little bit what we've been talking about. Your book, published several years ago now, we talked about a few years ago, actually, on the air. It's called The Job Training Charade. You do, I think, what very few other researchers have done. You looked at this assumption, which is so prevalent in our society, that education can create the next generation's workforce, that somehow education and training are a substitute for jobs on the ground, that if you educate, the jobs will come. Is that an inaccurate look at, or maybe I'll let you describe the book.
No, I think that that's right. And as you know, as I gather you were discussing, that's both that's a policy prescription at the federal level, and it's also the message that is given to people individually when they're out of work or when they can't get a decently paying job, which is essentially, it's your fault and it's up to you to fix it. Go back to school and learn something new. And increasingly, as I think you were discussing earlier, nobody can say what that something new is. And as downsizing and outsourcing has come to affect more and more jobs and more of what used to be the jobs that people got referred to, I think it's clearer than ever that education is not the can't be the answer at the policy level.
One of the things I think that Louis Uchitel brought out in his book is this idea, again, of a labor market that really does exist. So people are led to believe, for example, that the higher the educational level, the higher the achievement, the economic attainment. But that's not always the case. So, for example, supposing you have, one engineer available and there's two jobs, well, then that person's going to be in very high demand. But supposing there are four engineers available for one job, then they're going to bid down that price. And that's precisely what we're seeing in industry after industry, particularly like, for example, in high tech in our area to some extent, whether it's with the importation of foreign workers or just the bad economic conditions and layoffs. A lot of workers are very highly skilled workers end up competing for the same jobs. And that sort of gives a lie to the question of just educate them and the jobs will come.
Well, that's right. I mean, there are problems like that there are too many people for the same jobs. There are very often problems where American workers are forced to compete with whoever is the cheapest or most desperate worker around the world for their job. And, you know, it's not surprising that at this time when things are getting worse and worse, that people's anxiety about getting to college goes up because everybody feels like, okay, but I personally will get a leg up on the competition, or my kid personally will get a leg up on the competition if they go to college. And it's a little like, you know, people always make this comparison between the labor market and a game of musical chairs, which I think is right. You know, if your life depended on musical chairs, then what you would do was try to have, you know, really strong, big legs and quick instincts, and maybe that would help you a little. But when you look at the country as a whole, you know that most of the people are going to lose in that competition.
It's a great analogy because, you know, then you're contrasting the individual strategy for success, right, which is, you know, grow long legs and learn how to run quickly, with a collective strategy, which might say that, you know what, if we know that there's less chairs than there are people trying to get in them, maybe we're going to do something to make sure that everybody, you know, can share a chair or something to that effect. That's not what we're being that's not what we're discussing now. Instead, the government has, for example, with highly skilled displaced workers, people who who lost jobs due to trade, they have this elaborate set of benefits, quite generous really, to retrain them. But there's not necessarily any particular promise of a job after that. They're really on their own.
That's right. And in fact, you know, the things that people classically got referred to when they said, what should I train to? I mean, people lost manufacturing jobs and they were told, study high tech. Well, now more than 10% of the high tech jobs have gone overseas in the last couple of years. Or they were told, study nursing. Very similar things are happening to nursing. And so, you know, as, once you have people laid off from nursing or from high tech and they say, what should we study? Nobody has any idea what to tell them. And obviously there needs to be a national employment policy. And then some of that, you know, there are a lot of different parts to that. One part of that is simply job creation. And there are still a lot of valuable things to do that are not make work. I mean, we still go to parks and cultural places that were built by the public works projects of the 1930s and the Great Depression. There are a lot of things that need to be done in the country that could be done on that kind of basis, but there has to be the political will to fund them.
And there has to be resources, too. And not to keep bringing up this exclusively, but in his book, which, you know, I think he's, Louis, you know, Uchitel is you know, being a good reporter and trying to shy away from particular, you know, advocacy. But, you know, in fact, he does talk about, the old days of progressive taxation, where it wasn't a sin to think of taxing at a marginal rate of 50%. You know, the idea being that maybe a dollar given to a rich person buys less happiness than a dollar given to a poor person, because it makes less difference in their life. And so if government, if society as a whole were to get down and think about, you know, what's the way to create the most happiness, which is, I don't know, I'm being philosophical here, but, you know, to me that's what society is about. It's about us together, not just a collection of individuals that, you know.
Well, I think that's right, but also you don't even have to be that philosophical about it. A tax dollar, you know, tax relief given to somebody at the bottom of the economy will create more local, has a bigger multiplier, which means they're more likely to spend more of that in the local economy than the $70 billion tax cut that Bush just gave to wealthy people, which for all we know is going to go to investments in countries abroad or into buying fancy art or fancy cars or all kinds of things like that that won't create jobs here. And so there is, you know, there could be something done of raising the tax rate on the wealthiest people or the wealthiest corporations, but there's also obviously, you know, if just that tax break or just part of the money that went to the war in Iraq went to things like this, went to fixing the roads in Oregon, went to building more schools. I mean, there are all kinds of public needs that are not being met now that would also be job creation strategies for people here.
Let's talk about CETA. This is probably a program that maybe some people still alive remember. It was, after all, just in the 1970s that there was a federal government program to put people to work doing, you know, useful things in America's cities.
That's right. The CETA program got a lot of got blasted by people on the right by finding some examples of where there was fraud and things like that. But from everything we know, there was at least as much, if not more, fraud in the job training programs that everybody since then, including both Republicans and Democrats, have promoted. And I think the essential differences of CETA was that CETA was based on the idea that people were unemployed because there weren't enough jobs. And therefore, the right answer for the government was to create jobs and have the government be an employer of last resort. And, you know, you can control fraud and you can say, well, this is what people should be doing and not these kind of things, but these kind of things. I mean, there's an endless list of useful things that I think everybody would agree were useful and were not make work that could be publicly funded. So, you know, what we've lost in the time since CETA is, first of all, that basic idea that people are unemployed because there's not enough jobs and therefore the government should be an employer of last resort. And that got replaced with the idea that people are unemployed because it's their own fault, because they don't have the right skills or the right attitude, and therefore they should fix something about themselves rather than fixing something about the labor market.
Right, I just think that approach, blaming the victim, you know, again, it ignores the reality of a labor market. A labor market being, you know, how many sellers of labor are there, you know, compared to how many positions there may be. And anything that society does to change the labor market is going to have an impact. So, for example, if you give people Social Security benefits and that enables them to retire and step out of the workforce, that's going to reduce the number of workers competing for those jobs. Is going to have an impact raising the wages of workers. If you pass a child labor law and say that people under the age of 16 really oughtn't be toiling in factories and so forth, that's going to have an impact on the labor force in the same way. And really almost any program that provides some income support to people where they don't have to work for whatever reason, whether it's maternity leave or welfare, these all end up having an impact on the labor market. Back to back to the direct idea of buying and selling of labor instead of this idea of let's train them and then the jobs will come.
That's right. I mean, I also think, you know, one of the really critical points that Lewis,
it took me a while too.
That he makes in his book is about the emotional and psychological toll that it takes on people to be laid off. And, you know, I think this is true in any industry. I know for people who want to, grad students who want to get jobs as professors, which are very, very hard to come by, the truth is there's just a tiny number of jobs for the people who want them. But the experience for each one of those individuals who apply and don't get them, everybody I know blames themselves and thinks, if only I was, you know, worked harder in this way, if only I was smarter, if only I was more charming. And there's a tremendous emotional toll. So I think there's economic policy, but also, you know, there's this tremendous hypocrisy in the Bush administration to say that you're pro-family or that you're pro-community, and then to have these policies which leave people both economically wiped out but also emotionally wiped out, is one of the less talked about but really cruelest parts of this policy.
I'm not trying to flog the book relentlessly, but I'm going to confess that I'm a little bit of an economics geek. I find this stuff interesting. It's rather rare that I find a book that's a real page turner that hits you on an emotional level. This one, The Disposable American Layoffs and Their Consequences, does. I want to say, you know, one of the things he brings out, Lewis Uchitel, is that it's not just the individual who's laid off who's impacted. It's the family too. He looks at cases where, you know, the daughter and the son in high school kind of got their status, feeling because they knew that their dad was a well-respected person in the community. He was a bank vice president at a local bank. You know, when he's laid off, all of a sudden they respect him less. They don't feel as good about themselves, or they worry about him. You know, it's not just. I mean, I think that there are social networks out there. There are family networks that are all harmed every time an individual is basically disregarded and disrespected in that way.
Well, and you know, there's also decades of data that things like alcoholism and domestic abuse and depression and suicide and all those kind of things, drug abuse, go up in periods of unemployment. And so that, in a way, is a mirror to how the government wants us to think about unemployment, that it's all the person's fault who's unemployed. They also want us to think, oh, there's just these kinds of people who are drug users or who are abusers or who are something like that. And also to say, oh, we're serious about that, but we're going to have all of these layoffs where people are blamed and where people are left desperate, and we know what that leads to, is also part of the, I think, part of the horrible heartlessness of the policy.
In case you've joined us late, you're listening to Labor Radio on KBO Portland, 90.7 FM. We're talking with Gordon Lafer, professor at the Labor Education and Research Center at the University of Oregon and author of The Job Training Charade. Professor Lafer, or Gordon, if you like, a couple years ago this book came out, but I mean, I think basically all of the arguments are still perfectly valid. I wonder, one of the things you push in the book is this idea that job training is actually a political response as much as it is an economic response. It's not just that it's about trying to get people back to work. It's maybe about mollifying them or preventing some kind of a political outcry to the reality of modern mass layoffs.
Yeah, I think it's actually much more a political response when you look at the history of where job training comes from and what are the times at which it's promoted. I mean, you can see even in the actions of the Bush administration that they basically cut the funding to job training. They don't really believe in it. They don't want to support it very much. But whenever there's an unemployment crisis that could affect them politically, and I would include in this layoffs after 9/11, even Katrina, they turned to job training. When 9/11 happened and so many people got laid off in the tourism and airline industry, they promoted job training for them. And the aftermath of Katrina, for instance, this was one of the heights of hypocrisy, I think. The administration promoted job training as the answer for victims of Hurricane Katrina at the same time that it was cutting the wages that construction workers were going to make. When if you think about what job could you possibly get in a wiped-out New Orleans, almost the only place that, you know, on the people who are not professionals could look for work was in a big booming construction area. So to say, oh, we're going to cut the wages for construction workers, but we're going to tell everybody they should really get training and that's the answer, I think is one of many instances where you see that mostly how job training gets used is as a political excuse, kind of, to get the public off politicians' backs and to try to keep people from demanding more serious things like higher wages for construction or public jobs.
And to be fair, equal opportunity critic, you know, this was also very much the philosophy of the Clinton administration, you know, both terms. In fact, you know, a big proposal to fund job training came about directly tied to the Clinton administration's push of NAFTA. It was a sort of a fig leaf that was used to get some reluctant congresspeople to go along with it, the idea being that, well, yeah, sure, there will be some losers in this new economy, and they're going to have to get retrained, and that's a generous thing for government to do.
You're absolutely right. This was pushed as a response to NAFTA, and this has been something that Democrats, at least as much as Republicans, have pushed. And you know, I know this is a cliched thing to say, but nevertheless true. If you look at where the money comes from to support the Democratic Party, it's more or less, it's almost as dependent on large corporations as the Republicans are. So it shouldn't be a surprise to say that the Democrats want to come up, you know, when they're pressed to say, well, what are you going to do about poverty or unemployment? They want to come up with something that won't be offensive to business backers, and that thing turns out to be job training often.
Now, in the end, do you think that, you know, the government should have a role in job training and job placement?
Very small. I mean, I think there's a role for job training, but in general, you know, in general, it's a very small part of the problem, and the problem is that it's been promoted as a major response to unemployment and poverty when it can't possibly succeed in that kind of role.
I've also felt, quite frankly, just personally, that it may be a little bit of a dodge. It seems to me that if you were a company and you wanted to do something and you needed a skilled worker, that maybe in the old days you might train them. And now I think it's expected that the public is going to foot the bill for companies to train their employees.
Well, I think that actually happens more on the high end. We actually see it happening in universities, where even here in Oregon there is a lot of encouragement from the high-tech sector for the University of Oregon and other schools to have more engineering programs and things like that. At the level of entry-level jobs, I think what tends to happen is if companies really need somebody, then they hire them and they train them themselves. And the government programs are mostly are really just a ruse. There are not companies saying, oh, can we get the government to train us a cashier or to train us you know, any of the and non-professional jobs.
And maybe there could be some kind of a clawback, you know, if the public spends resources training someone and then they're laid off, the company might owe the, you know, the government something.
Yeah, certainly.
Gordon, I want to, we have just maybe a minute or two left in this segment. I know that you're working on something that's considerably absorbing, and we'll probably have you on shortly. It's the maybe the second of a three-part series looking at American workers' rights on the workplace, particularly to unionize. When is that second part coming out?
The second part will probably be out in the summer. And I actually will be participating in the Workers' Rights Board hearing that Secretary of State Bradbury is going to be overseeing.
Which you must have heard is the next topic in our show tonight.
I did hear that.
So, Gordon Lafer, it's always a pleasure to have you on Labor Radio.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for joining us. Just ahead, we'll be joined by Margaret Butler, who is with the Portland Jobs with Justice. She'll be talking about a forum, actually a hearing this Thursday, to talk about workers' rights to organize a union in Providence Health Systems. And there's a little bit of interesting, perhaps controversy about that. We'll get to that in just a second. I do want to thank, though, some organizations that make this show possible. SEIU Local 503, OPEU, whose mission it is to improve the quality of life through worker empowerment and a progressive labor movement, and whose members deliver quality public services to Oregonians every day. Also by Ironworkers, Shopman's Local 516, and the Pacific Northwest Ironworkers District Council, proudly fighting to preserve living wage jobs and resisting their outsourcing. For information, call 503-257-4743. Margaret Butler, are you with us?
I am.
Thanks for joining us tonight to talk just for a few minutes, and I think we're going to have someone on next week as well on Bill Zimmerman's episode of Labor Radio. This Thursday is going to be another, I guess, would you call it a hearing? There's this, I'll let you describe it, but the Workers' Rights Board is a project of Portland Jobs with Justice that brings together community leaders to focus a light on workers' rights abuses. What's happening this Thursday?
This Thursday, we're having a Workers' Rights Board Fair Election Oversight Commission that Secretary of State Bill Bradbury is convening, and we have a panel of Bradbury plus six other community leaders from the Portland area who are going to listen to testimony from workers at Providence in Portland and workers who work at other Providence hospitals in the system who've gone through union organizing experiences, as well as expert testimony like from Dr. Lafer about how biased and broken the whole election system is.
Right, American labor law passed in 1935 and really actually worsened in 1947. You know, union organizers that are trying to get people to join a union, I mean, to, you know, improve the aspects of their workplace, voice at work, respect, all that kind of thing, find it very, very difficult to organize when the employer has such the upper hand. They can call employees to mandatory meetings, sort of harangue them with all sorts of anti-union propaganda. Unions certainly have no equivalent opportunity to talk to workers. In fact, it could be very difficult even to find out where workers live. In this case, SEIU Local 503, which is, which organizes healthcare workers in Oregon, is trying to approach Providence health system workers at several hospitals, and they're finding it also difficult. And what they're asking for is for Providence health systems to commit to some basic neutrality, procedure.
To fair ground rules.
Right, right.
So that they wouldn't hire a consultant, they wouldn't do the captive audience meetings, they wouldn't do the one-on-ones, they would only communicate accurate information, and there would be equal access. And we've been helping Local 49 reach out to the community for probably a year now, and there are a number of community leaders who have been encouraging Providence to do this. So this is the next step, and Secretary of State Bradbury is really excited about looking at this issue of how do you get a fair election in a union organizing situation, and how can we help Providence workers have a fair shot at it, since
now,
his role is to oversee fair elections in the general.
Now, if I may say, it seems like quite a coup to have gotten at this point a statewide Democratic elected leader to get involved to this degree. They've been a little reluctant maybe in the past, but here he's going to officiate at this meeting. I understand there's been some pushback from the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, and Providence last week wrote letters to Bradbury, which I've read, and I guess I regard them as vaguely threatening. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. I have a copy of the Oregon Association of Hospitals letter here, and it inquires about Bradbury's authority to convene such a meeting, what his purpose is, what is a workers' rights board, what is a fair election oversight commission, and is this a public meeting, is there opportunity for public participation, and we aren't clear what the implications are, and we want to meet with you or your lawyer about it. And Bradbury wrote back right away and said, here's what we're doing. I care about fair elections everywhere. I can help make them happen. It's a really important thing. And the commission encourages public support of the democratic principle that workers have the right to a free and fair election, and invites them to attend. So we'll see if they decide to attend or not. There is,
and they have been invited.
They have been. Providence was invited a couple of weeks ago, and there is time in the agenda to take testimony from them.
Now, of course, you know, to remind listeners who probably are aware, but you know, Providence is a publicly chartered nonprofit corporation that's supposed to be operated as a charity in the public interest, providing you know, healthcare to the poor and that sort of thing, and basically, you know, saving us when we're sick. You know, there's some question about how devoted they are, perhaps, to that mission, or maybe to, I don't know, a fat CEO paychecks. Okay, maybe that's a cheap shot, but the guy's making a lot of money.
Right.
These guys are asking for a voice at work, you know, some of the lower-paid employees at the hospital, and they want the hospital to basically not try and crush their union campaign. How can people – this is a public event, right?
That's right.
Why don't you give us the time and the location?
Right. Thursday the 25th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Portland Building. The address is 1150 Southwest 5th downtown, and it will be in the second floor hearing room of the Portland Building.
Again, Margaret Butler, I want to thank you for joining us on Labor Radio tonight.
Great. Thanks a lot for having me.
For listeners who can't make it this Thursday, there will be further discussion of this next Monday on Labor Radio at 6 o'clock. Bill Zimmerman will be the host. That's about all the time we've got this evening. I'd like to thank our engineer, Ben Levine, and our guests for joining us. We hope you'll tune in again next Monday at 6 p.m. And stay tuned now for Time Sound, a program of soul music with host Kevin Berry.